Okay, here we go. The training world is full of technical editing courses that don't teach the high-end creativity that viewers expect. Inside the Edit was created specifically to teach you every single creative skill you'll ever need to mesmerize your audience. Hello, fellow filmmaker. Thank you so much for joining me here on the very first episode of Once Upon a Timeline, the official podcast of Inside the Edit. I'm your host, Paddy Bird, and once a week, we're going to be discussing my favorite subject, creative editing. We're not here to talk about bit rates or codecs or which editing software has this new feature or that new button. We're going to talk about pure creativity. We're going to break down lots of different creative techniques. We're going to study edit psychology and all the different mindsets that this art form requires. And we're really going to look at what it takes to build and sustain a career as a professional editor. That is the journey I really want to take with you, the journey to becoming a powerful creative editor, and not just someone who's memorized a bunch of buttons and shortcut keys. We've got a fantastic prize we're giving away on this very first episode. If you'd like to win an annual Creative Cloud license from our friends over at Adobe, all you got to do is answer one question. So stay tuned and I'll let you know how you can do that at the end of the episode. Okay, let's get started. I was thinking about what subject I'd like to start the podcast off with, and you know, I was racking my brains and I came to the conclusion it could only be one subject really, and that was the power of editing. It is insane how powerful this art form is. After doing it for so many years, I'm still blown away with what we can achieve on a timeline with some footage and some music. It's crazy. You know, a professional editor can take the raw elements of any project, you know, a 2-minute news report or a promo or a reality TV show or a drama or a doc, it doesn't matter. And they can craft them into multiple versions of themselves. So all these things can have different tones, different moods, different meanings. And we can create pretty much anything we want using different cutting patterns and stylizations. And all of this can have a very specific emotional impact on the audience. As editors, we're looking through our rushes, you know, and we're looking for structures, possibilities, variations, and patterns that we can use to build the most interesting and dramatic version of any scene. You know, our job is to be the first audience, but it's also to design an emotional roller coaster for our viewers. And so there's hundreds of techniques that are used to craft that exciting journey. I want to start off by telling you a story that kind of illustrates the power of editing. It goes back to the first day I started working on the reality TV show X Factor. I'd grabbed my coffee and I walked into the post house in Soho in London, met the director, and we sat down and talked. And, you know, he was telling me this is the kind of thing we want, and, you know, this is how much we're going to cut each day and blah, 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 you know, all the kind of usual stuff. And then he said, right, okay, here's your first set of rushes. Here's your raw footage. I want you to cut, you know, a 2-3 minute piece. We were actually in the early audition stages, you know, when there's like 1,000 people in one of those big stadiums or whatever. And the producers go through the crowd and they sort of pick out interesting stories, interesting people, and take those characters through and see which ones kind of, you know, come to fruition in an interesting way. So he showed me the rushes for the first thing I was going to cut and he left. He said, I'll be back in a couple of hours. And I watched through, and actually I was a bit dumbfounded because the character that they gave me, he was pretty bland. I wasn't that compelled by what he said. I wasn't that compelled by his journey. you know, the characters often give a reason why they're on the show or a talent show like that, as a kind of backstory and motivation. And even his reason wasn't that interesting. So I was kind of stuck on this first morning, given a bit of a lemon, and I realized that I had to make him interesting with my editing. This is so often the case in so many different genres. Sometimes nothing happens, and we've got to make something out of nothing. So I used three initial techniques to make this guy more interesting. The first thing I did was I got a construction of his interview. You know, I cut it down to maybe 90 seconds, something like that, and made sure it made sense. It had a start, it had a middle, it had an end. And then what I did was I spaced it out. I actually inserted pauses at certain points to make him sound more dramatic, more interesting. You know, when people talk to camera, it's very different. TV time and real time is very different on screen. People kind of invent their own pacing in the way they talk. And oftentimes, it's not as dramatic or compelling as we want it to be in an exciting sequence. So we have to re-time someone's speech, someone's interview, someone's sync, whatever you want to call it. So that was step one. Secondly, what I did was I selected a music track that was emotional. I mean, I'd even go so far as to say it was actually overly emotional. If we don't have particularly emotional sync, we can fix that with putting in a slightly more emotional track than the kind of emotional level of the sync, just to help it a little bit and tell the audience what we'd like them to feel at this specific point. We're kind of compensating for one of the elements in a sequence, in this case, the interview, not being as strong as we wanted it to be. So that was the second thing. And the third thing I did to get this to rough cut was I employed a couple of visual techniques. Firstly, I turned all the B-roll black and white, and I slow-moed it all. So it gave it a much more emotional feel for the audience. I actually used the offcuts in between when the character was listening to the interviewer ask questions, and he moved his head down and he moved his head up as he was listening. And I used those bits and slowed those down and turned those black and white. So it actually looked like he was really emotional and looking off wistfully into the distance, which had a really, really powerful effect. So I used these three techniques. I retimed his sync, I put on emotional music, and I did the visual techniques like, you know, turning it black and white and using some slow-mo. So I thought, that's great, it's time to watch this rough cut. And the most amazing thing happened. I started to get emotional. I was really invested in this guy's journey. Having watched all the raw materials and thought, okay, this guy's not that compelling. The summation of these three simple creative techniques had such a powerful effect. I actually started laughing because of how emotional I was getting. But this goes to the very, very core of so many different things we do in editing. The individual elements of interview, music, and B-roll have a very low emotional impact. But we put them all together in a specific way. We can hide any kind of problem. And not only that, we can make a sequence extremely powerful if we want to push it in a certain emotional direction. And that is just one example of the power of editing. I remember the moment this dawned on me way back when I started editing in the mid-90s. The power that we have to direct the consciousness, to direct the emotional state of our audience is enormous. It's also a challenge as well. You know, no two sets of raw footage are the same. They're always completely unique with a ton of, you know, individual issues that we have to figure out. So we as editors, we have a massive influence into any project that we work on. You know, editing is a subtractive art form. We're given a bunch of content, and we're asked to whittle it down into a film. That film could be a 90-second promo. It could be a 3-minute news report. It could be a 10-minute corporate film. It could be half-hour reality show or an hour-long documentary or a 2-hour feature film. It doesn't matter. What kind of matters is that inside all those rushes, 95% of which will end up on the cutting room floor, our job is to sit there and craft that 5%, that 2%, that 1%, whatever it is, into a beautiful and compelling emotional roller coaster of a story. You know, most people, when they talk about editing, they use parables like how Michelangelo carved his famous sculpture, David. There's a comparison of editing to sculpture. You know, famously he said, I just chipped away to reveal David. Well, yeah, that's great, lovely, beautiful sentiment. But how do I actually do that with editing? How do I create and build the specific emotions at each point in my sequence, even if it's 30 seconds or 2 hours? That's what I would like to know if I was learning editing again from the start. And that is the job of a high-end editor, to build and shape a unique sculpture on our timeline every single time, no matter what footage has been given to us. As a resource, I've actually created an example of this on our website. Head over to episode 1 on the podcast page of InsideTheEdit.com and you can watch 2 different sequences I've built for this episode. For both of them, I've used exactly the same footage, but through a combination of lots of different creative techniques, you can see that the pacing, the meaning, and the overall emotional effect on the audience is completely different, even though the raw materials for that sequence were pretty much identical. And that really is the power of this art form of ours. This is really interesting because it really highlights the difference between learning tech, you know, learning software, and learning art, learning the artistic process of editing. You know, in a technical course, we'd want to achieve a certain action or result, and so we'd go off and look up that button or part of the interface in a manual. And it's pretty easy to achieve. But if we want to achieve an artistic outcome with the footage, there isn't a button that is going to do that for us. You know, we have to craft and manipulate the footage on the timeline in a certain way that's going to create that specific effect that we want for the viewer. And that will probably require us to use quite a few buttons. And of course, none of these buttons are going to say, make montage faster or make this scene mysterious. Let's say I wanted to create some kind of, I don't know, expectation before a big event in a corporate film or a documentary scene. And maybe a nice way to do that would be to create a crescendo in the pacing, you know, boom, 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 you know, something like that, you know, a nice stylization. So what I'd probably do is I'd alter the speed of the cutting pattern leading up to that big moment. But then what I'd also probably do to reinforce that is time the end of that crescendo with a big change in the music that I'd selected. And that whole process is created in my mind. I've visualized that first. I've come up with a creative concept first, and then I've looked at the timeline and gone, right, how do I do that? And that's what really interests me. How do we actually create that emotion or that stylization or that feeling for an audience at this specific point in any sequence that we're cutting? You know, how do we bend and shape and manipulate the blocks on our timelines to achieve this result? That is exactly why I built Inside the Edit. And that is what I want to talk about here on this podcast. You know, creative editing, the craft of editing, is made up of so many different skills. But for me, when learning it, all roads kind of lead back to one concept. And I think this one is one of the most foundational, if not the most foundational, concepts in learning editing. And that is this: working backwards. So, you know, what does that mean? Well, let's ask some questions around this concept. what is the purpose of this scene, any scene we're cutting? What is the emotional outcome? Where do we want the audience to be at each point throughout, at the start, at the middle, and at the end? And this is a core concept, if you will. We need to know what we're going to do before we start cutting. We need to have a good idea about where we're going to go and what the point is of each sequence. If we just start arbitrarily cutting, it's going to be a mess. We need to have a definitive plan after we've watched the raw footage. So we're not going on an exploratory idea about where this is going to go and what's going to happen. We need to have a framework in our mind before we even touch the mouse and the keyboard. And that's really important for a number of really, really good reasons. If we've decided that, for example, this scene has to have jeopardy in it or tension or something like that, some kind of emotion, and we're cutting, say we're cutting a reality TV scene or a documentary scene. If we watch the raw footage and then we see there are elements within the raw footage that are not tense, that won't create jeopardy, those are going to be the things which we can leave on the cutting room floor immediately. Having an outcome first, before we start cutting, you know, having a good idea of a framework, is kind of like putting a set of lenses into our glasses. Like, this is the jeopardy lens, and then we watch and we start cutting. This is the crescendo lens. This is the sadness lens. You know, we can interchange all of these different lenses, these different mindsets, when we're looking and crafting a set of rushes, a set of raw footage. And it narrows down and focuses us on everything that we're building on a timeline. It helps us get rid of what we don't want, and it helps us keep what we do want. You know, what's going to help the scene. It gives us a target, and a target is so important when we've got 45 hours of footage and we've got to cut that down to a 50-minute documentary or reality TV show. We got such an overwhelm, usually, of footage that it's really important that we isolate the meaning and purpose of each scene before we start cutting. And once we do that, we've definitely started on that first step towards crafting a beautiful scene. Now, does this mean we've figured out every single cut and how it will be crafted before we start editing? Absolutely not. That's fine cutting. And, you know, there's always surprises and unforeseen magic that kind of happens on the timeline when we start structuring sequences and trying things out. That's not the point, though. The point is we don't want to be 100% directionless when we're building. Otherwise, what we're creating will be a mess. It'll be like a ship without a rudder. You know, we'll be sailing around all over the place with no destination. Our sequence, you know, it will go off in way too many directions and make no sense for an audience. You know, it won't be tight. It won't be fluid. And it certainly won't be coherent. For me, the power of editing is all about developing our ability to notice possibility in the particular set of raw footage that we're cutting today. What is its potential? How far can we take it? You know, how do we have to bend and shape it into the best it can be? Our audience, they want to feel excited, they want to feel passionate, they want to be inspired, they want to be entertained and informed, you know, depending on what genre we're working in. And for me, that's the beauty of this art form of ours, that daily jigsaw puzzle that pushes us and tests our creative abilities. Okay, so this is the point of the podcast where we're going to answer some questions from our community. Thanks so much for sending in your questions. The response really has been amazing. And there's some really, really good ones here. Okay, our first question is from, I think it's a company, The Habit of Seeing, in Austin, Texas, USA. And they're asking, Do you ever feel lip flapping is appropriate, showing people talking without hearing the voice? This is a great question. In England, we call it goldfishing, and I expect it's called something different, you know, in every country. So there are some rules for this, and we obviously talk a lot about this type of visual grammar at Inside the Edit. But let's open up this subject and explain it a bit. Firstly, where would we see goldfishing? What kind of genres is it in? Well, we certainly see it in reality TV, in documentaries, and also in entertainment shows. And it happens when characters are getting interviewed. But a great example to dissect in detail is in news reports. It's very common in a news report to start and end an interview with what we call a non-sync wide. That is a wider shot of the character being interviewed by the news reporter. Usually the reporter has their back to the camera and the character is facing the camera and talking, but from a distance. So it's a wider shot, a much wider frame than the traditional medium shot or medium close-up shot that would be the main frame size in a news report. Now, the news reporter's voice is commonly played over this non-sync wide, and they're usually introducing the character in some way. I don't know, Brad Wesley, a local car mechanic, witnessed the whole event, or something like that. That's been edited underneath the non-sync wide. And during that introductory voiceover and shot, we definitely see Brad talking. We'd see his lips move, but we wouldn't hear his voice track. Or if we did, it would be a very low dB level. Of course, we often see this at the end of interviews as well, as a way to cut out into the next part of the report. But, you know, it's also worth mentioning that we may also see it during the main part of the interview as well, where the editor has used it to hide jump cuts in the sync construction of the character. Sometimes, you know, that's the job of the B-roll, which is there to show, you know, what's the purpose of B-roll. B-roll is the secondary images of a person, place, or thing that the character or characters are talking about. But very often, and especially if there's not much B-roll available, an editor will use this goldfishing non-sync wide shot to cover up the inevitable jump cuts created by the compression, the journalistic compression of that interview. You know, the interview may be 10, 20 minutes, but obviously a news report isn't an unedited stream of that whole interview. It's a reconstruction and a reordering based on what the actual report is about. So this is a classic example of acceptable goldfishing. Of course, there's many unacceptable examples. But the general rule is this: goldfishing is not acceptable on closer shots in any genre. You know, your close-ups and your medium close-ups and your medium shots, simply because the audience will find it distracting if what they're hearing and what they're seeing, especially on a closer framed shot, doesn't match. If the audience can really see the lips move, they will want to hear what that person is talking about right there. A different voice track playing over the top of someone in a close-up or a medium close-up shot would definitely be frowned upon by a broadcaster, and it's highly unlikely that they'd let that one through to be transmitted. You know, don't forget, our audience is trained in a visual grammar in having watched so many news reports and TV shows and documentaries and dramas and everything like that. There is a visual grammar of what we can get away with, and this is one of those things. So yeah, very interesting question. A second question comes from Alma in Kosovo, and the question is, what does tempo mean in the editing process? This is very broad, but it's worth talking about. It's a really interesting subject. So tempo is really a multitude of different subjects. If you think about what we're doing in many parts of editing, we are re-timing. We are creating a new tempo, a new visual tempo with our individual raw elements. Now, we can create a new tempo with the sync, as we've talked about. We can create a new tempo with the pictures. We can cut faster. We can cut slower. We can create things like visual crescendos, boom, 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 with the pictures. Or we could do the opposite. We could create a diminuendo, which is a bop, 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 slowing down. These are all stylizational concepts and techniques that we use all the time. We compress certain areas to add drama and decompress in other areas to add drama and excitement. We change the tempo of all the individual elements coming in together for a multitude of reasons. And there's so many different things we can change. You know, if we're cutting an observational documentary and we want to give it that raw, authentic feel, we will keep in all of the pull focuses. We will keep in all the whip pans left and right and the unsteady camera work. That all is a part of tempo and creating tempo. And the reason we do that, certainly in reality TV and observational documentaries, is it's a stylization to create a sense of authenticity. Like we're actually there. We're trying to replicate the emotion of being there and the authenticity of being there. So tempo is a really broad brush that we use to paint across editing. We create tempo in the design of the sequences. We create tempo by allowing specific types of shots and camera movement into our sequence. And of course, as well, we create a new tempo by the specific music we choose in any sequence, if there is any. You know, that has a tempo framework. It may be a constant tempo. It may be a tempo that changes over time, that replicates what we want to do in terms of speeding up or slowing down our particular sequence for a particular emotional reason. Remember, every single frame in our sequence is there for a reason. There's no arbitrary frames or arbitrary things inside a sequence. All of it is designed by us. And certainly the tempo is at the very center of that. It's also worth mentioning that tempo is often the last skill to come for an editor, if at all. You know, you can really see the difference between an amateur editor and a good editor, or even a good editor and an amazing editor, by how they structure the tempo on their sequence. You know, it's a difficult skill to learn because there's so many different elements that we have to master. It's not just the speed of the cuts on our timeline. We dedicate an enormous amount of time to talk about this and show countless different examples in Inside the Edit about this, because it is a very, very complex subject. A beautiful one, but very complex. Our next question is from Anarchy in Cologne, Germany. How do you prepare for a long documentary before shooting? For example, how do you explore examples of already existing films? That's a great question. Being a director and an editor myself, I'm certainly all about the prep. Obviously, I'll be asking myself big questions before I start shooting. I'll be looking at my characters, I'll be looking at the journey, I'll be looking at the potential structure of the narrative, what action scenes are going to be in there, what kind of things am I going to be filming, what kind of style does that lend it towards, how do we balance that over a 30, 60, 90 or 2 hour film, depending on the duration. If I'm doing a film about, I don't know, racing cars, a documentary about racing cars or a character who races cars, there's going to be a whole bunch of really good films that I can watch, documentaries, dramas, that will prep my mind for interesting camera angles, structures, pacing in potential scenes. You know, there's a whole plethora of really good stuff out there, depending on what, you know, what I want to achieve. How do I want to stylize it? Do I want to use super slow-mo and, you know, how many camera angles for specific actions and all this kind of stuff? You know, I would look at the narrative. I'd look at the journey we're going on. I would look at interesting ways to tell those stories, those mini stories, the scenes and the action we're shooting in them in interesting ways, in ways that are different. You know, don't forget, of course, a documentary is different from a drama. You know, many documentaries are an investigation. You don't really know everything that's going to happen as you start filming. It's more of an exploration of the characters and the environment and things like that. Yes, you can have historical documentaries where, you know, not a lot is going to change in terms of this happened, then that happened, and it led to this over this period of time, of course. But we don't know what the characters are going to say who are going to be interviewed, and we might get something amazing that a character says that we hadn't researched or wasn't in the initial chats when we talked to that character when setting up the documentary interview. So we don't know. It's not as strict as a drama where everything pretty much, or a large part of everything, has been pre-thought out. You know, in a drama, there's dozens and dozens, sometimes hundreds of people working on this tightly oiled machine. You know, in documentary, you don't have that. You have a much lighter crew. You have, you know, a much lighter production in general. So I tend to look at stylizations and research stylizations and cutting patterns and structures beforehand and always think to myself, how do I do this differently? Or what does this character say to me? You know, the film that we shot for Inside the Edit, so all our members could practice on all of this footage, because that's obviously a major problem when learning the craft of editing. You need good footage to practice on. The character, Anthony, is this Californian photographer, and he gets up and photographs at dawn, which is a kind of very romantic, peaceful, you know, each kind of set is almost like an oil painting. It's like the most amazing light, and he does it in all these amazing locations around Europe. So meeting him and seeing the way he talks and the way he converses with the camera, and of course his art form, and looking at what he does and how he does it, and going out on, you know, on a practice shoot with him, I kind of designed the way that I wanted to shoot it. So pre-visualization is still a big thing in documentary. Not always. Sometimes we're just shooting something because we don't know what's going to happen. You turn up to an event and it's like, okay, what's happening? And you capture what you can. That's different. But I always like to be prepared, to be armed with ideas beforehand. You know, you don't always need to follow the plan when you're on a shoot. Things happen on a shoot, certainly a documentary or reality shoot, that are unforeseen. And you may go, oh, this is way more interesting than what I'd planned. Let's go down this rabbit hole. This sounds really interesting. I can't remember who said it. I think it was Napoleon or someone like that said, military plans are useless, but if you don't have one, you're crazy. And that kind of sums it up for me, which is like, look, I've got all these variations in my head and I will choose the one that feels right on the day. So research, research, research. If you've got a subject of a documentary you're filming, go and watch the top 5 documentaries or dramas on that subject and think, how can I take inspiration from this? But also, how can I do it differently? And what does my particular unique subject, what does it say to me in terms of style and structure? Unfortunately, that's all the questions we've got time for this week. But thank you so much for everyone who sent one in. If you'd like to have a question answered on the show, please do reach out on any of our social media channels or email me at podcast@insidetheedit.com. I'd really love to hear from you. So that wraps it up for our very first episode of Once Upon a Timeline. If you've enjoyed it, please do share it with friends and colleagues, and I'd really appreciate it if you left some comments or, you know, an honest review. Of course, if you'd like to actually start learning all of the high-end concepts we've talked about here, and hundreds more, if you'd like to go on that journey to becoming a powerful creative editor, you can head over to Inside the Edit and choose one of our membership options and get started straight away. We've got everything from a free trial or monthly membership to annual and lifetime options. We've helped thousands of editors and filmmakers around the world, as well as some of the industry's biggest media brands, to master the art of editing. I want to thank our partners at Universal Production Music, whose beautiful music tracks we've used in this podcast. You can click on the links below and license these tracks if you think they'd be perfect for what you're cutting right now. I can see these tracks being used in any number of beautiful reflective documentary or emotional drama scenes. They really are stunning, just like the other 500,000 tracks that that are over on Universal Production Music's website. Now for the competition. If you want to win that annual Creative Cloud license, courtesy of our friends over at Adobe, then we've posted the question on the episode one section of our podcast page at Inside the Edit. Simply email your answer to podcast@insidetheedit.com and I'll announce the winner on next week's show. Okay, that's a wrap. Stay home, stay safe, and stay kind. Much love to you all, and I'll see you very soon.